You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.
A little curious about the room, if you guys don't mind. If you are going to be out there protesting the Olympics, can you give me a hell yeah? Let's try it one more time. If you're going to be protesting the Olympics, can you give me a hell yeah?
Hell yeah!
All right, just curious. So, another quick question for you guys. Who said the following? See if people know this. I hospitalized a rock. I beat up a brick.
Muhammad Ali.
I'm so bad I make medicine sick. Yes, sir, Muhammad Ali. Now, who said this? Why should they ask me to go 10,000 miles from home and drop bombs and bullets on brown people in Vietnam while so-called Negro people in Louisville are treated like dogs and denied simple human rights? I've been warned that to take such a stand would cost me millions of dollars, but I've said it once and I will say it again. The real enemy of my people is here. I'll go to jail. So what? We've been in jail for 400 years. Who said that? That's right. Muhammad Ali, son of a house painter, came in almost last in his high school class. He's been called an idiot by sports writers throughout the 1960s, and yet he understood things that the so-called best and brightest of that time did not understand. He understood that there was racism, and he was against it. He understood that the pace of racial justice was too slow, and he understood that there was a war in Vietnam, and he opposed it. And he understood something else, too. He understood that his platform as the heavyweight boxing champion of the world allowed him to be heard in a way that others could not be heard. And I'll tell you something, I think he is at the heart of what is a hidden history of radical politics in the hyper-exalted, brought to you by Nike platform that is professional sports. And I think that we don't learn this now. Even the most devout sports fans do not know this history. And I say that from experience because I grew up an absolutely rabid sports fan. I mean, I memorized every statistic. I like collected baseball cards and read the backs. I mean, my mom thought I was crazy. She couldn't get me to read a book, but I'd read a stack of baseball cards. And yet, I also played like every sport except for golf, which is not a sport. Now, this is like a very simple metric for people that I like to spread when I speak. It's if you can smoke cigarettes or gain weight while doing it, it's not a sport. Not a sport. Like if you can actually get fatter while doing something, you can't call it a sport. You just can't do it. And I'll tell you something though. That's how I saw sports. I saw sports as something over here, politics over here, and I didn't know anything about this history. And that started to change for me actually because of an athlete who ended up here in Vancouver, a basketball player by the name of Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf. People may know the name. In 1996, Rauf played for the Denver Nuggets. And he made the very private decision that he was not going to go out for the national anthem before games. He did not see why nationalism and saluting the red, white, and blue and the American flag, what the heck that had to do with being a basketball player. So he stayed in the locker room. A reporter came and asked him about that, and they said, hey, so why aren't you going out there? And he said, look, it's a personal thing. I just don't like the nationalism. I'm just not going to go out there. And the reporter followed up and said, yeah, but don't you realize that that flag, that red, white, and blue, that's a symbol of freedom and democracy throughout the world? And Rauf responded by saying, well, maybe it's a symbol of freedom and democracy to some, but it's a symbol of oppression and tyranny to others. Now, when he said that, it was like the sporting shiz hit the fan. I mean, ESPN was like, Rauf spits on the flag, booyah, din-in-it, din-in-it. And he was effectively drummed out of the league after a short stint in, you guessed it, Vancouver. And the last stop. And I remember watching this at the time, absolutely amazed. And one of the commentators on ESPN said in a very sort of derisive way, yeah, Rauf must see himself in the tradition of those activist athletes, you know, like Muhammad Ali or Billie Jean King. And that phrase just shook around my head, like activist athletes? What the holy hell is that? And so, you know, I went back and tried to find writing about the activist athlete, and there's precious little of it. But if you dig deeply enough, you find out that there is a radical heart beating in sports. They try to destroy it. They try to obliterate it. They don't want a new generation of sports fans and a new generation of athletes knowing that this history exists. They want to turn it all into something very friendly, the way Malcolm X is now on a stamp, the way Martin Luther King is on a McDonald's commemorative cup, and the way that Muhammad Ali as well has had his political canine teeth excised like a political root canal. And that's what has to change. And I want to say something very briefly about Muhammad Ali, because part of his story is also an Olympic story. Like, his radicalization is about the Olympics. It's about the 1960s, but it actually started with the 1960 Olympic Games. He was 18 years old. He was Cassius Marcellus Clay Jr., and he had a dream, and it was to bring the showmanship of professional wrestling into boxing. If you'd asked him who his hero was in 1960, he wouldn't have said Malcolm X or Martin Luther King. He would have said Gorgeous George Wagner, who was a professional wrestler. And on his when he was about to get on the plane to go to the Olympics in Rome, he said, "To make America the greatest is my goal. So I'm going to beat a Russian and I'm going to beat a Pole. And for the USA, I'm going to win the medal of gold. And the Greeks are going to say you're better than the Cassius of old." And everybody was like, "Oh, he rhymes," you know. And how charming. And he did win the gold medal. He went back to Louisville. He attempted to order a burger with his gold medal around his neck, and he was denied service. And as he later said, he took his gold medal and he gave it a home at the bottom of the Ohio River. And he started to look for answers. He could not understand how he, this exceptional person who won a gold medal, could be treated like a dog in Louisville. So he started to look for answers, and he found them in the politics of the Nation of Islam and Malcolm X, and he went public with that. And actually, for a short time, he changed his name to Cassius X, was how he was signing autographs. And this part is just so interesting, like images of Ali after fights, young Cassius X sitting with like Malcolm X, Sam Cooke the singer, Jim Brown, the football player, and they're all sitting around eating vanilla ice cream after a fight, talking politics all night. is a wonderful thing. And I think audiences today, people don't even realize what that meant about the heavyweight champion of the world joining an organization that called white people devils, for example. And I mean, you'd have to think about what a common parallel might be today. Like, it would be like Sarah Palin joining the lesbian Avengers. I mean, not that they would have her, but it would be that kind of thing, of somebody so stepping out of their box. And as he said to the press after he joined the Nation, and they were all like, "How could you join that group? What's wrong with you?" He said, "I don't have to be who you want me to be." And of course, he took it to another level when he became the most famous draft resister in the history of the United States, saying, "I ain't got no quarrel with them Viet Cong." And I don't think people realize, like, today's Ali the Saint, he was the most despised athlete in the world in the 1960s in the mainstream press. I mean, people like Barry Bonds, they think they might have it hard. They got nothing on Ali, what he went through. And I just want to read an example of that. The most famous sports writer of his day was a guy named Jimmy Cannon. And him and Red Smith were probably the two most famous. And this is what Jimmy Cannon wrote about Muhammad Ali. And you see, like, Ali, the mere fact that he was young, black, proud, and by the way, also as the boxing champion, didn't hesitate telling people how pretty he was, which was also, like, what's that about, you know? And I mean, he drove these guys insane. He made them unhinged. And this is what Jimmy Cannon wrote about Ali, and he calls him Clay, by the way, because like most newspapers, there was an editorial policy against even calling him Muhammad Ali. So this is what Cannon wrote. He wrote, "Clay fits in with the famous singers no one can hear, and the punks riding motorcycles, and Batman." I don't know why Batman was so dangerous. "And the boys with their long, dirty hair, and the girls with the unwashed look. And the college kids dancing naked at secret proms." That wasn't my college. I don't know what his idea. "And the revolt of students who get a check from dad. And the painters who copy the labels off of soup cans." It's like Andy Warhol, I guess. Warhol's like, "What did I do? I just draw soup." "And the surf bums who refuse to work. And the whole pampered cult of the bored young." I mean, my God, that sounds like something the Unabomber would write. That's like Teddy Kaczynski writing this insane statement. And Ali, of course, people may know the story. He had his title taken away from him. He wasn't defeated in the ring. It was taken away from him because he opposed the war in Vietnam. And he once held a press conference where people expected he would back off. when it looked like he was going to have his title stripped. And he sat down at the table, and people were like, okay, Ali is going to say, all right, I'm going to join the USO. I'm going to wear red, white, and blue trunks. I'm going to do some. That's all they asked him to do. They didn't ask him to go behind a rice paddy and get his head blown off. They just wanted him to you know, to front for the war, basically. And he sat down in front of the press, and he said, keep asking me how long on the war in Vietnam I sing this song. I ain't got no quarrel with them Viet Cong, because I'd rather be in jail fed than be in Vietnam dead. And people were like, okay, I guess he's not going to join the USO. Yeah. And so it's 1968, as people here, this is a very politically educated crowd, you know, 1968, mass struggle, heaven and earth changing places in so many ways. And one of the least discussed parts about that year that I think is that Muhammad Ali, no title, he spent that year speaking on college campuses. He did 200 talks that year. If you think about that, four a week, 52 weeks, that's what he did. And you read the transcripts of the talks, he's in front of young people, college students, and they're loving him. And he's saying, can they take my title without me being whooped? And they say, no. He said, who's the real champ? And they're like, Ali, Ali. He's like, ah, you know. And he felt great. And he also, this Olympian, also had a tremendous impact on a young group of people who called themselves OPR, the Olympic Project for Human Rights. People may be familiar with the famous image of Tommy Smith and John Carlos raising their fist. It's the poster for the event tonight. So everybody should be familiar. It's on right there? Good, thank you. Otherwise I'm like, you know, there's this thing that happened. I'm glad you said that, pretty stupid. But a lot of people see it and think it was a moment, but it was actually a movement. It had been going on for 2 years, and it was a movement to organize African-American athletes from actually participating in the 68 Olympics. They said, why should we run in Mexico City only to crawl home? And they had these amazing demands. They said, okay, we will participate in the Olympics, but we have four demands. One, we want Muhammad Ali's title restored. Demand number one. They said he is the warrior saint of the black athletes' revolt. Two, we want more black head coaches hired. Three, we want South Africa, Rhodesia, and all apartheid sport nations to have no place at the Olympic Games. And four, we want Avery Brundage fired. If you don't know who Avery Brundage is, go outside and step on something gross and look at the bottom of your shoe. You'll have a little idea of who Avery Brundage was. He's the guy who, he ran the International Olympic Committee basically from 1936 when he personally helped deliver the Olympics to Nazi Germany. And he ran them through 1976. I mean, it's like, if you read the history of the Olympics, he's on the wrong side of every question of racial justice, of justice for women athletes. He helped sanctify the gender binary about men over here, women over here, and hermaphrodites must be sex tested. I mean, this was Avery Brundage's contribution to sport. And it's like, I swear, I read Olympic histories, and Avery Brundage said this, I'm like, geez, why won't you die already? It's like, throughout the 20th century, he's there, saying the wrong thing. It's my own personal thing. And actually, if people see the gloves that they're wearing in that picture, the origin of that is that Tommy Smith bought those gloves because he was concerned that if he won, that he would have to shake Avery Brundage's hand. And he said, I don't even want my skin to touch his skin, so I'm buying some gloves. That's how they got the gloves. And they realized, though, that they would have to do something. And so they did this. And if you look at the picture, you can't really tell from that picture, but it's an amazing, amazing moment. Like, they're also wearing beads to protest lynching. They're not wearing shoes to protest poverty. And there was a third person on this dais. He was left out of the poster here. And a lot of people see him and they think, oh, that's the white guy. You know, as if he's like Forrest Gump. Like, oh, history. Wow. But he was an Australian runner by the name of Peter Norman. And when you see the picture in full, you see he's wearing a solidarity button. Yes. And they actually said to him, like, do you want to raise your fist too? And he said, no, this is your moment, but I want everyone to know that I supported it. And there's a statue of what you see right there at San Jose State now. And the statue does not have Peter Norman. It just has the two of Tommy Smith and John Carlos. And John Carlos, who's become a dear friend, John Carlos said that he was not going to go to the unveiling of the statue in protest because he said Peter Norman needs to be there. And Peter Norman said to John, he said, no, 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 you should go and I'm going to go too, but let's make it on the condition that when they make the statue, it becomes public space, and if people are doing political rallies, someone could stand where I was and do rallies and whatnot so everyone else can have the experience that I did of standing with you. It's Amazing. And Peter Norman, he passed away way too young in Australia, and the two lead pallbearers at his funeral, Tommy Smith and John Carlos. So I think the point of that is to say, I think sports is a wonderful way to actually teach people about our hidden radical past. And also, it's a way to actually reclaim sports. Because what do they always say? They say sports, politics, those aren't supposed to go together. While at the same time, they sell corporatism through sports. They sell war through sports. They sell racism, sexism, homophobia. I mean, my God, I'm from a town where there's a team called the Redskins, for goodness sakes. I mean, the racism runs. So, and by the way, they're called the Redskins because the team was owned by a segregationist named George Preston Marshall, who was trying to sell the team to the American South. And so that's the root of the Redskins. The original fight song of the Redskins was Fight For, now it says Fight For Old DC is the fight song. It used to be Fight For Old Dixie. So the idea of Native American mascots and white supremacy are deeply rooted in indigenous names. So it's all wrapped in the history, and that politics is okay, but the politics of radicalism they try to crush. This is definitely true. Am I doing okay on time? Because you can pass me a note to shut up at any point. And people can also vote to have me stop talking at any point. But I'll insist on there being a second, though. And this is also true with women's sports. I mean, I think looking at the history of sexism, in not just in the United States or North America, but in the world, and understanding it through sports is really fascinating. Like, when sports first became, like, organized, because there's a whole history of informal sports that goes back, you know, generations, centuries. But when sports first became organized at the end of the 19th century, it was something that women were simply denied. Well, not all women. Wealthy women had access to sports through country clubs, but the sports they had access to, first of all, it was golf, which, as we discussed, not a sport, and it was tennis, which was hardly a good thing. I mean, because at the time, women had to play tennis wearing corsets. Like, I don't know if you've ever wondered why women's tennis is the best of three sets and men's tennis is the best of five sets. It actually goes back to this time, because women's tennis actually did used to be the best of five sets. The best of five sets. The problem was that women were passing out on the court because of the corsets. So the people who ran tennis got together and they're like, "What should we do about this? Should we get rid of the corset? Nah, let's not get rid of it. Let's make it best of three sets instead. That way there'll be less passing out." And corsets remained an enshrined part of women's tennis well into the 20th century. Until a 15-year-old named Lottie Dodd won Wimbledon, and she won it because she got a corset exemption and was allowed to wear her school uniform when she played. And she later made an impassioned plea saying that the tournament could have been so much more interesting if her opponents did not have their breathing impeded. That was her. So she spoke out. She spoke out for the right to breathe, which is very nice. But sports was also for women. It was, if you look at, like, the words and the speeches of the earliest women's rights activists in the United States and the suffragettes, they always saw access to sports as being one of their demands, right up there with the right to vote, because it was about having the right to health. It was about having the right to camaraderie. It was about also having the right to have a space for women to be together and be social that would be otherwise denied. And men at the time, I mean, the people who ran sports, I mean, you had quack science, you had the church, all saying that sports would, for women, would, I mean, you name it. I mean, just name an ill, and that would happen to you if you played sports. I just want to give an example here. This is from the 1878 edition of the American Christian Review. It's the 12-step downfall of any woman who would dare engage in the sinful world of croquet. And it's it's a slippery slope. Step one, social party. Sounds good. Step two, social and play party. Step three, croquet party. Step four, picnic and croquet party. Not a picnic. Step five, picnic, croquet, and dance. Step six, absence from church. Step seven, immoral conduct. Step eight, exclusion from the church. Step nine, this one's my favorite, more croquet. Step 10, poverty. Step 11, shame and disgrace. And step 12, ruin. So you had all of this lunacy, insanity, about this idea of women dared engage in sports, and yet it came head up against an invention that changed the way women saw sports and saw themselves, and that invention was the bicycle, exactly. Because one reason is that you cannot wear a corset and ride a bicycle. Like the very act of having to ride a bicycle. It meant movement, it meant exercise, and it meant taking off clothes that were actually part of the oppression of being a woman at the time. And I mean, and the early suffragettes saw it. Susan B. Anthony said the invention of the bicycle has done more than any movement or change in our time. Elizabeth Cady Stanton wrote, "Many a woman is riding to suffrage on a bike." But quack science once again rose up heroically to say that women should not ride bicycles. They actually produced papers, and I've seen them, that if a woman rides a bicycle, it could cause, this is their words, not mine, the implosion of the uterus. Now, I am waiting. Someone has to start a women's punk band called Imploding Uterus. I think that would be amazing. There also was the American Medical Association, they produced a very widely trafficked paper that spoke about concern that women, and just women, were susceptible to something they called the bicycle face, which is a medical condition where excessive riding of a bicycle would leave you with a, quote, this is a quote from doctors, a permanent scowl consisting of a protruding jaw, wild staring eyes, and strained expression. My God, sounds like Dick Cheney. You ride a bike, you'll become Dick Cheney. And this is a very different talk, but throughout the 20th century, and I've done talks on this, it's fascinating, like throughout the 20th century, you see this battle that constantly exists of this sentiment that the United States, you know, it's this level playing field and anyone can make it, they try hard enough. And then the reality of the unlevel playing field, the reality of access, whether it's about gender, race, class, or what have you. And that's exactly what makes sports such an incredible platform for dissent. And that's why people associate Billie Jean King, for example, in her Battle of the Sexes match with Bobby Riggs, or Martina Navratilova with actual challenges to sexism, to homophobia, because that's what surrounds women's sports. It's like a river of sexism, a river of homophobia, and you either have to challenge it or navigate it. And when you navigate it, it often has very tragic results. And you see that like in Playboy's Women of the Olympics issue. It's like if you're a woman and you're going to play sports, this is what is expected of you. It's what they used to say, girls first, athletes second. And yet what to me is what it shows more than anything else is the way sports really is like a hammer. And you could use a hammer to build a house or you could use a hammer to beat somebody over the head. Like sports in the hands of the people who run sports can be incredibly oppressive, but if we fight to reclaim sports, it can be something absolutely revelatory. And I'll tell you, that's why I think what the Olympic Resistance Network is doing is so incredibly important. To me, it's about reclaiming sports. And I've spoken to a lot of people today. Oh. Yeah, absolutely. And I was at Simon Fraser University today, and a lot of people did ask me this question about, will people say about us that we're anti-sport? What do we say about that? And I'll tell you what I said then, I'll say it now. The IOC is anti-sport. The IOC is taking billions of dollars that are getting sucked away from physical education programs in Vancouver and the surrounding areas. It's taking billions of dollars away from high school sports. So it is, in practice, preventing young people from playing sports. And it is sending a message that says, some people, the Olympians, get to play, and the rest of you get to watch. And that is about privileging sports, not reclaiming sports. So the IOC is absolutely anti-sports. And I'll tell you something else about the IOC is they have something called the Olympic Charter. And if you've never read the Olympic Charter, you should read the Olympic Charter. Because my dear friend who just passed away, Dennis Brutus, former poet laureate of South Africa, and a person who was, in 1976, Sports Illustrated called Dennis the dark genius of dissent, which to me it sounds like Montgomery Burns stroking a kitten in his lap or something. But no, Dennis was the sweetest guy in the world. He was Gandhi crossed with Yoda, for goodness sakes. He wasn't the dark genius of dissent. Well, but what Dennis did was, for decades, whether he was in exile, whether he was in Robben Island prison, whether he was on the run from police, whether he was being shot in the stomach, whatever, he had the same argument that he stubbornly adhered to for decades, which was, how can the Olympic Charter say it's about peace and it's about bringing people together and yet kowtow to apartheid nations? How can it say those things at the same time? And he pounded that argument home over and over and over again. And I spoke to him before he died, and I told him, hey, I'm coming out to Vancouver. What do you think? He said two things. First, he said a line that someone else said that he was adopting, but it's still very funny. He said, ah, to be 80 again, which was great, which he took from Lester Rodney, who's another amazing old sports activist dude, whatever. But the point is about what Dennis said is he said to me, talk about the charter. Talk about the charter. Because I absolutely think that you should hang the IOC with their charter and say, how can the Olympics be about peace and bringing people together when police officers are visiting people's homes in Vancouver? When they are creating these Orwellian concepts like free speech zones, whatever the hell that means, for God's sakes. Every zone is a free speech zone, for God's sakes, or this isn't a free society. And how can they say that the Olympics is about community? Because this is all in the charter. How can they say that when people are being kicked out of their homes? And how can they say the Olympics are about anything to do with justice when they are happening on stolen land? How can it be that? So, and then you say to the IOC, you really only have one choice. Either abolish your charter or abolish yourself, because they cannot exist side by side. So just to close, I just want to say I've been so impressed, and some of them are here tonight, I've been so impressed with the people I've met today. I think this convergence is going to be a huge success for the simple reason that it is bringing together all the different strands of what the Olympics bring to a city. I mean, I've met people who are opposed to police brutality, people who are opposed to displacement, people who are opposed to budget-busting graft. And to bring people together and to make that kind of a statement is truly history. I mean, you guys are on the side of the angels, and I really do believe that people are going to be writing about what you guys do in February for years to come. So absolutely, Godspeed, go get them. Thank you.